It's a 90-minute tape converted to 60 minutes. This is the interview of Mr. Harry Jung. Interview number 12, tape 3. The Southern California Chinese American Oral History Project, jointly sponsored by the UCLA Asian American Studies Center and the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California.
Okay, you said that people had quite a bit of money left over to save back before the war.
Mm-hmm.
How did they save the money? In banks and deposit boxes at home?
So you have to remember that the Chinese primary motive for immigrating into the States was economic. And I would say that the great majority of them came over were those who found it economically disadvantageous to remain home, despite their land holdings, like my father, for instance, had quite large holdings of land. So that when they came over here, the primary motive was not settlement in a new foreign country, to make their homes here. The motive was to amass a fortune. And we use that word well advisedly, because I remember many Chinese who were gleefully happy to return to the homeland with savings of $10,000, which is quite a large sum of money. And it was not easy to save that money,
mm-hmm.
but those who did, you have to recall, were immigrants who were here without families. They were the victims of the Chinese exclusion laws, which forbade them to bring their families with them. And so for those without families, making only anywhere from $60 to $80 a month, they lived in a room. They ate moderately well, because the Chinese always managed to eat well. Things were not too expensive. So by very, very frugal living, they saved their money. Now, did they put it in banks? In the early days, not many did. In the first place, I'm talking about the very early 20s now.
Mm-hmm.
They were illiterate, not only in English, but even in their own language. You see,
mm-hmm.
many could not even sign their names in Chinese. And so the old saying was the coffee can underneath the mattress, you see. And so in that way, they saved money. There were families of my mother's own acquaintance, because they came over on the same ship, and they operated a restaurant in Ogden, Utah, which was a great railway center at that time. And I remember we were in San Francisco, which would be now, and remembering that they came over in mid-1900s, or late, I don't recall which, it might have been, well, my mother might have met them on board ship on her second trip back, but on one of them. And subsequently, they reappeared in San Francisco on the way home,
mm-hmm.
you see?
Mm-hmm.
And this story is interesting in that they subsequently returned very shortly. And we were surprised, because apparently they had done well as a man and wife. And then the sad story came out that they, in those days, everybody hoarded in their savings. It was all gold coins. Everybody got paid in gold.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in gold coins. And instead of buying a bank draft, they hoarded the gold coins and was put in a secret compartment in the bottom of the trunk. There's a Chinese trunk factory in San Francisco that specialized in that. And so, on arrival in Hong Kong, they opened the trunk. It's filled with rocks. Somebody had gotten into it aboard a ship, they believe.
Uh-huh.
You see? Because most of the seamen on ships plying the Pacific in those days were Chinese. You see? So it was a sad story. And so, that's typical, not typical, but it's a case of how people hoarded their money. In fact, there's a colleague of mine in the office whose father was a very successful laundryman, successful in that he was able to amass quite a fortune, bought a lot of property here, and on his infrequent trips to China, back to Pyongha,
mm-hmm.
he knows from his own knowledge that deep in the ground of the living room in Pyongha,
mm-hmm.
there are coffee cans of gold coins. And of course, he doesn't believe that they're there now. You see, so you say, how do they save their money? It was 40. And as an aside to that, it may be interesting to note that one of the best things from the standpoint of being assimilated into this community was the inability of the older Chinese to return to the mainland. Now, and the saying goes in Chinatown, now all the money came out from under the mattress and they sank roots here and bought property. Not only their own homes, apartments, store buildings, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, the loss of the mainland for the local Chinese was a blessing in disguise. Now they are more part of the community in that they have an economic interest now. Before it was merely a job, one job to the other, it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because to them it was, although the years were long, some of them come 20, 30 years before they were able to amass that fortune of around $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
That was the goal, everybody, you see.
Mm-hmm.
How
many people went back to China, or what was the percentage?
Great numbers. Sailing, the entire third class and steerage of the dollar lines were filled with returning Chinese. And they all had money. But of course, by the late 20s and early 30s, well, they were taking home bank drafts. Our money had already been sent back, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm recalling the very early days from what I hear from my elders, you see,
mm-hmm.
of so-and-so. Well, he's made it now. And, or the saying goes, he's eaten enough potatoes now. It's time to go back, you see. Although in today's terms, when you talk about, $75, $80 a month, to them it was a handsome salary. More money than they would have ever made over there, you see. And because of the lack of social activities and lack of social obligations and that there were no social intercourse,
mm-hmm.
you see, other than a few single fellows, mm-hmm. you know, they were able to put away most of the money that they had earned.
What about gambling? How popular?
Gambling was very popular. In the days in San Francisco, how there was no gambling in so-called gambling dens, the Chinese lottery flourished, and that was like the Irish sweepstakes for the Americans. That was the eternal hope of the Chinese. I remember one man, a nice old man who maybe had a share in a very good Chinese jewelry store in San Francisco. He had come over here for many, many, many years. When I remember, it was just prior to my going back to Hong Kong in 1933, he had won a considerable sum of money in the lottery. I don't know how many thousands of dollars. And I can still recall the sense of elation that now the chains of bondage have been broken. You see, you know, he worked. And see, people like him had families over there. And annually, we would be sending money back. So the actual on-hand savings were not much, you see. And so with this windfall, oh, he was on cloud nine. I remember he bought me a watch, took me to dinner, and then subsequently he came back and I met him in Hong Kong, you see. And the idea is to go home and retire. You see, they normally would go home and build a new house, mm-hmm. you see, mm-hmm. and spend their last days there, mm-hmm. you see, because they feel that with the rate of exchange and how much more cheaper things are over there, that the small fortune that they had amassed would last a lifetime. Yeah, of course, in the meanwhile now, it was the thing to do to make it possible, by some means or other, to have the sons come over, for them to amass their own fortune in return like the father would do, you see?
Mm-hmm.
You see? Now, like mm-hmm. this colleague of mine, whose father buried money, gold coins, coffee can,
mm-hmm.
all right, and he, the father, and this friend, my colleague, and a brother, were on the verge of returning to China, and the father was ready to return, and the sons were ready to set up in Canton when, you know, the mainland was lost, you see. So that's mm-hmm. another blessing in disguise for the two sons.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always a constant flux of Chinese coming in, one way or another. And gradually, some of them were able to bring families over, and then they raised their children here. And the more children they had over here, there was less likelihood of their returning because the children didn't want to return, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the people going back, those were the people without families who sojourned here. In their mind, even they've been here 35 years as temporary, you see. Some, they wouldn't reveal how much they're saved. They say, it won't be long now. They say, it won't be long now. Mm-hmm. One day, they pick up and they go home. See, they had, none of them sank any roots here. You see.
Mm-hmm.
So that going back was very natural.
How about for your parents? You don't think that they
Well, of course, my father passed away when I was 6 months old, you
right.
see. And in those days, it was unheard of that a widow with a son would remarry, you see. So where was she to go, you see? The hopes of my mother were in me. There was no thought of going back, you see, because all her family, that is, her sister's brother, they were all married. They all had their families, you see, and they were doing quite well. And I suppose that there was a feeling of inadequacy if she were to return, had an answer, so to speak, you see. So in my own immediate family, there was never any such thought, although my father's property now had been turned over to me. So I did have a home to go to were I to return, which of course I had no thought of returning, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Although the word return is used rather loosely in this case. As a matter of fact, on my visit to China, when I was there, the people in the village asked when I was going to return to build my own home. I was living in my father's house, you see.
Mm-hmm.
My father had purchased two other plots, you know, for residential building in Pyeonghae, you see, adjoining his house. And so they pointed to the plot and said, when are you going to build? And of course, I had to be truthful to them, said I have no intention to rebuild. However, my nephew wanted to stay in Pyeonghae, and I might help him build a house. As a matter of fact, on my last visit in 77, my nephew told me that my father's, the back wall of my father's house had crumbled. It's a brick wall, you see. And asked me if I wanted to repair it, rehabilitate the place. And I asked him why. He said, well, it's father's house, it's grandfather's house, your house. And you surely don't want it like that. I said, if I rebuild it, are you going back to live in it? Would your sons go back and live in it? No, I said, there isn't any point. I said, if I were to rebuild that house, then I would want to build out in front too, So there's no thought in my mind. My home is here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you asked me yesterday, do I consider myself more American, more Chinese? In that respect, I'm strictly American, you say.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Chinese when to my advantage, and I'm American when it's to my advantage, On the other side of the coin, you say.
The best of both worlds.
I think I have that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you know of any Chinese who were involved in politics in any way, whether it's politics here or in China?
All right. Over there, the only thing political that I knew of was a cousin who was the eldest son of my mother's sister, who was confidential secretary to the young Marshal Zhang Xulan, remember?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was in his entourage, who, because of what had happened in the North China situation in the mid-30s, took a vacation in Europe. I met him and he returned to Hong Kong. And so that's the only one that I know of. If you want to call it that, political, it's more quasi-military.
Mm-hmm. How about here in the States?
And then the one other one is that a schoolmate in Kimono followed me. He was very active in provincial politics, in Guangdong province.
Mm-hmm.
But here, no, I don't. Not personally. The only one I ever heard of engaged in politics was when Fred Wong, the attorney who was later disbarred, ran for the school board. And then there's a Edmund Jim, whose grandfather, house in which I was born,
mm-hmm.
He has aspirations for a seat on the city council.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very active with the Japanese group because their grandfather and their father, I think now, they own property in Japanese town.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all that I know of.
Do you know of any Chinese Americans who were political in supporting China during the war?
Which war?
Or 1911, in China and so
forth? No. You mean the revolution?
Mm-hmm.
Our revolution over
mm-hmm.
there? No.
People here, Chinese.
No, I can't remember that.
Mm-hmm. You said you were born in the house of the grandfather of Edmund Jung. So did your mother give birth to you at a home with a midwife? And
no, with a doctor.
With a doctor at home.
And this doctor, interestingly enough, apparently attended many Chinese birth because, coincidentally, it was a woman, Dr. Ruth Purcell,
mm-hmm.
also attended the birth of my wife, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Chinese, by word of mouth,
right.
You see. So, apparently, she was popular and well-known on the Chinese community during that era.
Mm-hmm.
No, in those days, I never heard of any Chinese woman giving birth in hospital. You see, the Chinese had a tremendous aversion to hospitalization. The old saying, I remember the older people saying that the enter a hospital is a one-way trip. You see, mm-hmm. going there to die, you know, that sort of thing. So hospitalization was the last thing in those days.
Mm-hmm. That's because they waited so long.
Well, I think I don't think they had any faith in Western medicine, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And like even in bone fractures, they believe in tipa,
mm-hmm.
you see. Now, I remember, for instance, when I was hit by a car, I was still in San Francisco, living with a family then, when my mother came down,
mm-hmm.
and I was left there. And we were horsing around on Sunday morning in a car. And she came down. I wasn't taken to the hospital or anything. I had a dislocated right shoulder, left shoulder, forgotten, bruises all over. And I remember going to an American doctor, and I think it was fluoroscoping maybe, mm-hmm. at most, because I didn't get any treatment. But the man who did treat me happened to be the manager of a Chinese hotel. Do you know San Francisco at all?
A little bit.
You know what Cannes is?
No.
A restaurant?
No.
You know where the Bank of China is? That
yes.
pretty bank? Well, uh-huh. across the street there.
Uh-huh.
Right above Eastern Bakery.
Uh-huh.
That building was a Chinese hotel one time. Still is, probably. And he managed that hotel, because I think we had a room there. He lived there one time. He was well-versed in Chinese medicine. Now, he wasn't a Chinese herbalist, I believe. And he fixed me up, you know, with tita and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where my mother was eternally grateful, and when I graduated from high school, I remember we drove into Fresno. He had retired, to look for him, because I didn't remember him, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He was an old man. He remembered me. And so there's an example of, you know, where doctors needed, you know, Western medicine, you know, was not soft, you see. But, and so I queried sometimes what happened. We could put both in bones. Oh, we can set it and use teeth out. There's no, you say, now whether the bone sets it right or not.
Mm-hmm.
He said, like this friend of mine, was born and raised in China Chido here and playing basketball. His arm was crooked. So it wasn't set right. He said, well, he has full use of it, but just crooked. You see.
Mm-hmm.
So those things came up there.
Mm-hmm.
You see. Now, like my godfather was my great benefactor. Everybody thought he was born a hunchback. I'm like, I don't know. I did subsequently learned in latter years. He fell out of a tree. And they never knew him. And hurt his back, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up with a humped over. And he would have been a tall man because, gee, he was short. Of course, he was short-waisted by being humped over, but he was awfully long legged. You see? So there's an example of, you know,
mm-hmm.
the Chinese not favoring Western medicine. It's, you know, the old background.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hmm. How do you think the Chinese in L.A. were affected by the Depression?
Oh, like anybody else, as much as others, excepting, you know, when money was scarce, those who had hoarded their money were able to produce money, get it out, you see. Yes. And also, too, when banks closed, those who had hoarded their money laughed at those who were so progressive as to let the Americans handle their money, you see. But as far as income and so on goes, I think they were just as badly affected, excepting you didn't have Chinese bread lines. You see, you didn't have Chinese selling after them, you know, and more or less, you know, how the Chinese are always taking care of themselves, you know. And you know, the Chinese say, same amount of food, extra pair of chopsticks, what's the difference, you see, you know. They live by that philosophy, and they weathered it.
Mm-hmm. Think the families were very helpful, you know, to each other?
Oh, sure. They always have been, always will be, you mm-hmm. see.
Mm-hmm. Other people I've interviewed say the Chinese they still managed to eat well during the Depression.
Oh, you see, Chinese food was traditionally, until just recently, cheaper than eating foreign food. You see, because, now think for a minute, delicious as the aroma and everything is, very little meat. You see, mostly vegetables, and basically for cheap, mm-hmm. is it?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in American food, each entree is a meat, is it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has to be sufficient meat for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And for the amount of meat that one person eats in an American meal, a Chinese can chow and have a great big plate for everybody. So it was cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason they were able to eat well of their own food, which mm-hmm. they preferred anyway.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel there was hostility towards Chinese in LA? We touched upon this a little bit yesterday.
I cannot say that there was hostility. That's, you know, because the word hostility to me has connotations of violence, physical, physical
mm-hmm.
injury, and that sort of thing. No, I did not feel it nor see it. Perhaps it's because in my own life, I kind of shied away from situations where there would be what you might call hostile feelings about me. You say, yes, there are places where people who are Chinese are not welcome, so you don't go there, you say.
Mm-hmm.
And
like what kinds of places?
Well, during the late 20s, early 30s, I've heard people say that certain restaurants, the Chinese were not welcome, you see. And so you don't go. But I have not been treated with that type of reaction or command in any place. Perhaps I didn't go to those places or I couldn't afford to. But I remember one incident which will be, I think, may be of interest. When we were living down here, it was an annual trek we made to San Francisco with our old friends, particularly Chinese New Year time. And I remember one day very distinctly, coming out of the Emporium, walking on Market Street, we passed by a barber shop, and my mother said, I better get a haircut in the barber shop. So we went in there, and I recall being bluntly told that you don't cut Chinese hair. That's the only one overt incident of prejudice, or because he wasn't hostile, he just outright came and said, we don't cut Chinese hair here.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't recall, to me personally. That's not to say others might not have been, because I suppose for those who were looking for work, you see, and seeing it, competing with the Americans,
mm-hmm.
There might have been, overt signs of hostility, because here was a foreigner about to take a job away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there might have been something like that, but I was not in that situation ever.
How about in movie theaters? Some people have told me that they were told to go upstairs where their ticket was supposed to be good for downstairs too. But
no, I never heard of anything like that. I never encountered anything like that. And in fact, the only such incident I ever heard of was a Japanese fellow in Seattle. He told me that he would, he wanted to sit in the orchestra and they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not heard of any.
You went to the movies quite often.
Oh yeah, because it was a cheap form of entertainment. My mother enjoyed it. And,
Have you ever heard, or have you ever yourself compared Chinese with Jewish people in their way of doing business or success?
Oh, it's interesting. The reason I laugh is when I was with the Chinese government in New York, I was manager of imported sales, and one of our biggest lines of imports was hog bristles. And some of the biggest brokers and buyers were Jews. And how do we compare with them? How sharp we are. I was taken only once, and only once by a Jew, you see. And it was a dropping market, you know, it was a falling market, but he wanted a lot in the morning. And it's by the afternoon I called him up, I said, when do you want me some documents? He said, what documents? He said, no such thing. He said, yes, we talked about it. He said, I didn't want it, you see. And so, and I told the boss about it, so his admonition to me was, remember, a Chinaman is better than two Jews, was it? And and then later, when I joined Steinhall and Company, they were a Jewish firm. They were shrewd, but I don't think the Jews are any shrewder than the Chinese.